Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours today, and it's open forum. So if you'd like to dial, now's the time to start, 888-318-7884. Open forum is open to anyone on the planet Earth. If you can dial a phone, you can call 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. I got a stack of books here. A Daily Defense is one of his books. The Fathers Know Best, that's about the church fathers. Teaching with Authority, that's about church doctrine and confusion around which doctrines are more or less significant than the others, how you understand what the church really teaches. And then the latest, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Jimmy also, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, I see that you've got colorful sticky notes as bookmarks in Teaching with Authority. That suggests that you or at least someone has actually cracked that one open. That's awesome.
Yes, I have indeed cracked it open. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I guess as a Catholic, you learn certain things about doctrine and dogma and all that. Not all of it is either precise or in every case even correct, but you just kind of go along with your, I thought, for example, that encyclicals have a certain significance that they don't always have. And one of the things that you continually point out is it's not just about what the document is. It's also about what the nature of each statement in the document is. So it's kind of fun to find out about how this all actually works.
Yeah, and it's not only in Catholic circles that people, you know, hear things. I mean, no matter what faith tradition you come from, you hear certain things that are just part of the ethos that, you know, you absorb as a result of being part of a religious community. And people in every religious community generally don't build their religious views one doctrinal atom at a time.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, they pick it up to some extent by osmosis from the people around them.
But this is a very helpful one. Among all your books, also very popular book, the most recent one, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Already the phone's starting to fill up. Let's see, we got, I was going to say how many lines we got open, but I can't because we don't have any open. 888-318-7884, the number. I feel like let's just go to the phones and see what the questions are today.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right, let's go to Odessa, Texas with our friend Devante. Hang on a second, Devante. You there with us, Devante?
Yes, I am. How are you guys?
I'm very well. You know why I call you our friend?
Why is that?
Because we've been talking with you quite a bit lately. It's starting to feel like you're
I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, well, it's always nice to talk with you. Go ahead. What do you got for Jimmy today?
Yes, sir. So what is the role of the Treasury of Merit with the giving of indulgences?
Well, so we'll define both of those terms real briefly just for folks who may not be familiar with them. An indulgence is an occasion where the church intervenes using the authority that Christ has given it to help ameliorate the consequences of a sin that's already been forgiven. Because even after we're forgiven for our sin, there are lingering consequences. You know, the book of Hebrews talks about that, how even for Christians, God scourges every son whom he receives. So, you know, there are consequences after we've sinned, even once we've been forgiven, the eternal consequence of we'll be in heaven. And Christ gave the church the authority to intervene in the process of healing after sins, and an indulgence is a case where that happens. The thing that the church draws upon in intervening in this way is sometimes called the Treasury of Merits, and the Treasury of Merits principally consists of what Christ himself did, because he paid an infinite price on the cross. And so as a result, the Treasury of Christ's merits is infinite. God has also chosen to associate us with the work of redemption, though. Now, we can't pay for our own sins, but we can help by doing things that please God and that can help other people heal from their sins. And so there's a sense in which other things that people have done that have pleased God also can be drawn upon in this way. It would be a little complex at the moment to try to give a full course in the discussion of indulgences, but if you Google a primer on indulgences and my name, Jimmy Akin, you'll get a document coming up that contains the biblical basis for these concepts. And also there's a companion piece called Myths About Indulgences. So if you Google Myths About Indulgences and Jimmy Akin, that'll provide some additional perspective. Also, I cover both of these in my book, The Drama of Salvation. And so, Devante, I don't know if you already have The Drama of Salvation, but if you don't, why don't we see if we can send you a copy?
Oh, that sounds great. Devante, hang on. And let me just write a note here to Annie, who's running the phones today. And if you would like to get that book, just hang on. We'll get your address and we'll send you a copy of Jimmy Akin's book, The Drama of Salvation. Thanks, Devante. Let's go to an anonymous caller now in Sacramento, California, watching on YouTube. Anonymous, are you there with us? Hi, Anonymous. Okay, I'm going to come back to you, Anonymous. Oh, I got excited. I thought I heard some action, but not. We'll come back to you. Let's go to Richard in San Pablo, California, listening on the Catholic Answers live app. Richard, I'm hoping you're there, Richard. You got a question for Jimmy?
Sure do. So I have an RCI student, and she had asked about the different types of Bibles, the differences between them, and I didn't have a quick answer to her way to describe it.
Okay, well, there are a bunch. So the most fundamental difference between different types of Bibles deals with what books they have in them. And if you're looking at a Protestant Bible, it's likely to have one set of books. If you're looking at a Catholic Bible, it's going to have a few additional books. If you're looking at an Eastern Orthodox Bible, it'll have a few more than that. So it's going to depend on what faith community you're a part of, exactly what books you'll find in a Bible. Then there's the question of the text of those books, and that's in most of the Bibles that people get, it will be a translation into their native language, like maybe English, although it is possible to get Bibles that are in the original languages, which in the case of the Old Testament is Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and in the case of the New Testament is Greek. So you can get original language Bibles, but most of the time what people are looking for are translations. There are different styles of translation. They kind of fall along a spectrum. Towards one end of the spectrum, you have translations that try to go more word for word in how they translate things. Sometimes these are called literal translations. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you have translations that don't try to stick to the words in exactly the same words in exactly the same order as much, but instead they try to translate the thought into your language in a way that's easier to understand. And these are sometimes called dynamic translations. It's really a matter of personal preference, which you like. Some people like the more literal translations because they preserve more aspects of the original language, even though that makes them a bit harder to understand. Other people prefer the more dynamic translations because they're a little bit easier to understand, even though they do omit certain aspects of the original language that otherwise could show up in the translation. Beyond that, it's a question beyond the text of the books of the Bible. It's then a question of what additional aids are there to help you as you study the Bible. Many Bibles have footnotes that will clarify or try to clarify various things in the text. Some of them have introductions to the different books in the Bible that give you some background on, you know, who wrote this book and when was it written and what kind of circumstances does it try to address. There can be all kinds of different study aids that you'll find in Bibles, especially ones that are flagged as being study Bibles. That can include not only notes and introductions, but timelines and essays and maps and cross-references and all kinds of different things.
I hope that that's helpful to you. I appreciate the call. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Jimmy Akin, Open Forum, right here on Catholic Answers. I hope you have recovered from last week's Focus interview with a real-life exorcist. If you're still freaked out by that one, we started this week with an episode on blessings with Father Hugh Barber. That should help you feel better. But on Wednesday of this week, we have our most controversial episode ever. Here's the setup. Lots of Catholic media personalities have been suggesting that Pope Francis is a bad pope. So we got a bunch of clips from their shows, and we asked an expert on the papacy, what if they're right? We're not trying to pick a fight with anyone, but we got into some really frank discussions about what some of these well-known media personalities are saying. Catholic Answers Focus, you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Watch it on YouTube or listen anytime at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hey Alexa, how many ways can I get EWTN?
You can get EWTN on television, via cable and satellite, on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Google Play. You can get EWTN radio in your car on Sirius XM Channel 130 and on the go on any mobile device with the EWTN app. And here's the best news. Now you can get EWTN's great programming on me.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest both hours today is Jimmy Akin. It's open forum. We are open to your call, whoever you are and wherever you are, 888-318-7884. You most certainly don't have to be a Catholic to call, although every single one of our Catholic brothers and sisters is welcome. You don't even have to be a Christian to call anybody. 888-318-7884. And of course, Jimmy is very open to a very wide range of questions. Before we go back to the phones, I got to remind you the store-wide sale is on right now at shop.catholic.com. Everything is on sale, including the School of Apologetics courses. Head over to shop.catholic.com today and check out the deals. Let's go back to Sacramento and see if our anonymous caller is with us. Anonymous, you there with us?
Yeah, I am. Sorry. I had it on mute.
I do it all the time. No problem, Anonymous. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. Can Catholics pray the Chotki from Orthodox?
There's nothing in principle in the prayers that I'm aware of associated with that tradition that is problematic from a Catholic point of view. And so you can say any prayer you want that doesn't express false doctrine or contain anything immoral. And saying the Jesus prayer with a different set of beads is perfectly moral. So I don't see an issue with it. Now, there may be some versions that could be problematic, but in terms of the devotion in general, there's not a problem that I'm seeing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anonymous. Appreciate the
call. No problem.
Who's up next? Let's go to Valparaiso, Nebraska, listening on 102.7 FM. That's Spirit Catholic Radio in Nebraska. Is Jeff. Jeff, have you got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yes, I do. I have a question about abortion, and it's a kind of a two-part question because I was talking to somebody else over with it today, and I was wondering if there's what vaccines, the flu vaccines, have, what is it, known for having abortive fetuses for the, I guess, the starting out cellular,
cell lines.
Makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sorry.
All right. So the question then, Jeff, is: can you take these vaccines that may have been manufactured using the remains of or cells that are derived from aborted fetuses? That's basically the question, Jeff?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Jimmy.
So it's important just for people who may not be aware that what we're talking about here are not ongoing abortions that are being used to produce new batches of the vaccine. There are various cell lines that are used as part of medical research that ultimately go back to miscarriages or deliberate abortions that were committed in the past. And those are over and done with. So it's not like they're killing a new baby to make your dose. This is something that involves a historical sin, but it doesn't mean an ongoing one. And consequently, Catholic medical moral experts have looked at this question and have said that it is in principle possible, since there's not an ongoing sin, to use vaccines that were originally developed in this way. But there are also concerns about that, because you don't want to incentivize people to continue this type of research. If you'd like more information about all that, actually, it's been discussed a bit by the Pontifical Academy for Life and the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in some of their documents. But you can find documents dealing with it more specifically and directly on the website of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. That's ncbcenter.org, NCB for National Catholic Bioethics, ncbcenter.org. They'll have material on that, and I know we've discussed it numerous times here on our pro-life biomedical open forums.
Thanks, Jeff. Hope that was helpful to you. Let's go to New York City. Austin, watching on YouTube in New York City. You are next. Go ahead, Austin, with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. My question is, in New Testament, Jesus says the Father is greater than I, and I'm mm-hmm. assuming that's because of his human nature. So I wanted to know if the Holy Spirit was also higher than him, and if he's if Jesus is higher than himself somehow, since he's also like God of himself.
So I understand the issue that you're thinking through here. I tend, when Jesus says the Father is greater than I, some people think that he's speaking in that, he's using that language because he's speaking in his capacity as a human, which he is a human, but he's also God. And you can take it that way, in which case the Father, speaking of the Father, you know, is divine, because the Father is divine, is greater than Jesus's human nature. So is the Holy Spirit, and so is Jesus's own divine nature. So, you know, you could look at it that way. My own inclination is to look at it a bit differently. Instead of talking about who has which nature, because all three of the persons of the Trinity have a divine nature and Jesus has a human nature, my own inclination is to look at this a bit differently. Because even within the order of the persons of the Trinity, there is a distinction in how they're sequenced. The Father is what's referred to as the, in Greek, it's the arche of the Trinity, the source or origin of the Trinity, from which the other two persons proceed eternally. So the Father eternally, outside of time, begets the Son, and the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father through the Son. And so, because this is outside of time, there was never a time when the Son didn't exist, and there was never a time when the Holy Spirit didn't exist, but they do proceed from the Father in this way. And so there's a sequence to their order. And that's one of the reasons why we refer to the Father as the Father and the Son as the Son, because fathers are the origin of their sons. And so, since the first person of the Trinity is the origin of the second person of the Trinity, this Father-Son language is appropriate. Now, having said that, within the order of even just a human family, there is a difference in the roles of fathers and sons. And within a single human family, the father can be said to be greater than his son. That doesn't mean they're different in nature. They're not. They're both human beings. If you have a father and his grown-up son, they're both men, they're both adults, they both have the same nature, they both have equal dignity in that sense. But within the order of the family, the father could be said to be greater than the son. And so my suspicion is that's what Jesus is talking about here. He's not talking about having a different nature, that, oh, well, I've got this little bitty human nature compared to my father's infinite divine nature, because he also has an infinite divine nature. So I tend to think that this is more about the order of the persons within the Trinity and the roles that they play within the Trinity, which is why Jesus consistently presents himself as coming to earth to do the Father's will, just like a human son might be given a mission to perform by his father, and then he goes to do his father's will.
Thank you. I appreciate that question, Austin. I hope that that was a helpful answer. We go now to Georgetown, Guyana, where I was so delighted to get that call from William the other day. First call we've ever taken from Georgetown, and I believe it is William again. William, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for calling again. Happy to have your call here. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. I'm a Catholic who got himself into a Protestant group, and I became very well, very good friends with them. And there was a little strange situation in there when I was apparently prophesied to four times by two different people. And my question is, does God still speak to people through prophecy?
Okay.
Well, God does still sometimes speak to people through prophecy. That's quite true. The Catholic Church recognizes that private revelation is ongoing, and so God does sometimes give people a vision or an audible voice or something like that that gives them information to help them live out the Christian faith. That's very far, though, from saying that every single occasion where someone claims to be prophesying is an actual one where that's happening. There are a lot of situations where people are imagining that they're receiving a prophecy when in fact they're not. There are even cases where people hoax receiving a prophecy when in fact they know that they have not received one. And there are situations where they may be in contact with a supernatural entity like a spirit that tells them something, but it may not be a spirit that's come from God. One of the things we have warnings about in Scripture is we should not trust all of the spirits because some of them lie, some of them are demons. And therefore, when a person thinks that they've received a revelation, it needs to be tested. This is something that St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5. He says, don't despise prophesying, but test everything and hold fast to what is good. And so there needs to be a sifting process. If someone claims to give you a prophecy, it needs to be tested to see whether or not it's really coming from God or whether it's not. And that's all the more the case, the more consequential the prophecy is. The more implications it would have for your life, the more rigorous that testing needs to be. And if you'd like information about how to do that kind of testing, I'd suggest you check out a few episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I've done one specifically on how the church evaluates private revelation. So you could type in Jimmy Akin, Mysterious World, Private Revelation, and check that out. I've also done episodes on particular revelations where I go through and I apply the principles to do the testing, and you could check some of those out as well.
Thank you very much, William. I appreciate the call. I hope we will continue to continue our conversation with you. We'll get to continue our conversation with you is what I meant to say. Thanks again. We're going to go now to South Dakota, where I don't have a name on this caller. Jennifer. Jennifer, you've got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yeah, hi. Okay, so I am not currently Catholic. I was raised LCMS Lutheran, but my boyfriend is Catholic. So I've done a bunch of research and like looking into the faith over the last 2 years or so. And one thing I still kind of struggle with is relics and the veneration of them and like what their importance is or like why Catholics do it or where they kind of got that from, like where it started and just kind of just the why.
Why all this relic stuff, Jimmy?
Well, it ultimately goes back to something that's built into human nature. And so in one sense, veneration of relics is as old as humanity, because humans have an inbuilt, and this is a human universal, it appears in every time and culture, we have an inbuilt sense that when someone dies, we need to treat their remains with some form of reverence. And this leads to customs like burying people, you know, or cremating them or doing something with their bodies. We don't just throw their bodies out in the street. You know, I mean, there may be times where in times of a mass death situation, there's no alternative. But in normal times, we don't want to do that. We want to care for them properly. And there's more to say about that, but we'll say it on the other side of the break.
Jennifer, can you hang on for just a few seconds?
Okay.
All right. Hang on. We'll get back with Jimmy finishing up his answer for you on relics. And then we will continue with our open forum both hours today with Jimmy Akin here on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
How did you propose to your spouse?
Was it more traditional or a little creative?
That's what we'll talk about tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Jennifer in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, listening on 94.5 FM Real Presence Radio, is on the line with us with a question about why we Catholics venerate relics. Jennifer, are you still there with us?
Yep.
All right. Jimmy, why do we venerate relics?
So as I was indicating before the break came along, humans have an instinct that God built into us to treat the remains of other human beings with a special form of respect. You know, we don't just throw their bodies out in the street when they die. Every culture has some way of reverencing these relics, reverencing these bodies, and dealing with them. In some cultures, it's burial in the ground. In some cultures, it's cremation. In some cultures, it's what's known as a sky burial. But regardless of the form, there's always some way of reverencing them. We also do things like putting up tombstones and monuments and in some cases statues and things like that. And when people go to a graveyard, especially one, you know, where their relatives are buried, they show a special reverence at the graveside. You know, if you go to your, I don't know, hopefully not yet, Jennifer, but if you've lost a parent or a grandparent or someone close to you, you go to their grave, you know, you show respect when you're at their grave. And that's essentially what Catholics do with relics of the saints. These are, it's just a different expression of this universal human tendency. And so just like different groups of humans do show their respect for human remains in different ways, especially those who are close to them, their family members, we Catholics show, and other Christians, you know, I mean, Orthodox do this as well and so forth. So do other Eastern Christians. We show respect for the remains of departed members of our Christian family, especially those who are notably holy in a special way, because they're even closer and were in life even closer to God than most of us are. And so they're worthy of extra respect.
Now, Jennifer, this is all new to you. I just wonder if that answer was helpful. Do you need a follow-up?
No, that definitely helps. I haven't had it explained that way before, so thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope you will continue to call as questions come up. Appreciate the call. It's open forum today. Jimmy Agin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, among many other books, and the proprietor of Jimmy Agin's Mysterious World. Up next is TJ in Needville, Texas, watching on YouTube. TJ, you got a question for Jimmy?
Yes, sir. Good evening.
Good evening.
My question is, when you are trying to discern whether something is sinful or not, and you go to read through various theologians and authoritative figures around you, and there's a conflict in opinions between various mm-hmm. authoritative voices, how do you discern which is the right way and the wrong way?
So it'll depend. One distinction that I'll make is what I'm reading an official church document or not? Does it represent actual church teaching? And even beyond, is it a document issued by the church? I need to discern, is it a teaching document? Because not every document is meant to be something that communicates doctrine. But what I'll try to do, kind of as my first line of recourse, is say, okay, am I reading something that is doctrinally authoritative or not? Or am I reading something that is an opinion that has been formulated either by a bishop or a theologian or something like that? And if what I'm reading is an opinion, then my inclination is to try to think through the issue myself and say, okay, what are the arguments that are being proposed and are those arguments plausible or not? If I'm not able to assess that, and a lot of folks, you know, not being moral theologians, aren't necessarily in a position to assess that. But if I'm not able to, then we arrive at a situation that actually there's been quite a bit of discussion about in the history of Catholic thought, because you would have situations arise where you've got, even, you know, hundreds of years ago, you'd have some Catholic moral theologians taking one perspective and other Catholic theologians taking another perspective. And how do you sort out which is the way you need to proceed if for you, you've got to get this question settled because you need to know how to act in your own life? Well, there are a couple of extremes that have been identified, both of which have been judged wrong. One of the extremes is called rigorism. And rigorism says you cannot, if you have a safe alternative and a less safe alternative, like do this or don't do this, you can only do the less safe alternative if you're either absolutely sure or really, really confident that the less safe alternative is correct. Laxism is the opposite of that. Laxism says that you can go ahead and do the less safe thing unless you are really, really, really sure that it's wrong. The correct approach, therefore, tends to be somewhere in the middle. And there have been different schools of thought that have been discussed over the course of time. They have fancy names in Catholic moral theology, like probabilism, equiprobabilism, and probabiliorism, and compensationism. But what they involve doing is looking at the relevant circumstances and looking at the state of opinion among Catholic moral theologians. And if I had to boil it down obviously I could give us a little mini course in all of this, but if I boiled it down, if there's a significant division of opinion and it seems relatively equally balanced between theologians of one perspective and theologians of another, providing they're all Orthodox faithful Catholics, you know, we're not talking about dissenters, then if one has a pressing need to act, one can go ahead and act on whichever view seems most advantageous, even though it's not absolutely clear which one is to be preferred.
I hope that that is helpful to you, TJ. Appreciate the call. Our number here, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's open forum, and the phones have just been staying full. That's why I just keep going quickly from call to call, but you are welcome to give it a try throughout this hour and next hour. Jimmy will be with us, 888-318-7884. Heading to South Africa now, watching on YouTube, is Ryan. Ryan, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, happy to have you. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes. So my question is about. I'm currently exploring the Catholic faith and considering becoming Catholic. And something that I have trouble understanding is purgatory, and more specifically the treasury of merit. From reading the Catechism, it seems a little bit unclear to me about. If there's a specific sort of mechanism that is prescribed for us to understand it, by which I mean it doesn't seem as though it's necessarily prescribed to be a penal substitution, for example. So it seems to me that it might be open to the interpretation that the treasury of merit and our sort of purgatory isn't necessarily a penal substitution, but possibly the fact that we're meditating on the good deeds of the saints, and that helps us to become purified. So my question is sort of, is that a valid interpretation? Is there a more orthodox interpretation of how exactly the treasury of merit works? Because the Catechism doesn't seem to be super clear on that to me.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess to answer the question, I need to approach the history of the doctrine of purgatory at least briefly first. The New Testament, the Old Testament as well, but the New Testament contains language that is penal in nature, meaning it involves punishment. Like we said earlier in this episode, the book of Hebrews talks about how God scourges every son whom he receives. And there are other, you know, places where this punishment or penal language is used in terms of how God deals with us. And so one of the things that has happened down through the course of history is one model of how purgatory works is a penal model, where people are punished for their sins in order to satisfy God's justice. Even though the eternal penalty has been remitted, still it was, you know, God would view it as, okay, it's still fitting they receive some punishment, just like we, you know, if we have a child that's disobeyed, the child needs to learn their lesson, and so we'll go ahead and punish the child even though we've forgiven them, because they need to learn their lesson, let's say, or justice needs to be satisfied. And so that's led to what some have called the satisfaction model of purgatory, which is essentially a penal model. On the other hand, there are other aspects of the language that the New Testament and the Bible uses that suggest something different. If you look at the same passage in Hebrews where it says God scourges every son whom he receives, it makes a comparison to a human father and says, well, look, our human fathers disciplined us according to their pleasure, but God disciplines us for our own good. And that could be understood as saying, well, look, a human father may sometimes discipline because that's his pleasure. I mean, he's mad at you and he wants to punish you. But that's not why God does it. God disciplines us for our own good. And the result of that is growth in holiness. And so this has led to another understanding of how purgatory might work that's known as the sanctification model, that would hold that to the extent purgatory does involve suffering, the purpose of that suffering is to help us grow in holiness by losing our disordered attachments to things, you know, that would distract us from God and so forth. So it's essentially, it does involve suffering, but it's a medicinal function that that suffering is performing. God's not punishing us for some other reason. He's, we should understand these punishments in terms of their medicinal effect, not some other effect. And this has been, this sanctification model has been gaining ground in the last 50 years, let's say, in Catholic circles. It's always been there from to one degree or another, but by 1992, when the Catechism was released, you had these two models. You had language supporting both of the models in the Catechism, and it wasn't really clear how they were meant to sit together. The Catechism didn't try to resolve the issue one way or another. It just presented both types of language when describing purgatory. After the Catechism was released in 1999, John Paul II gave an audience on purgatory. And in the audience, he basically conflated the two models. And he said that even though we've traditionally used this language of temporal punishments to refer to what happens in purgatory, those punishments must always be understood as part of God's merciful justice, not just his justice, but his merciful justice that causes us and leads us to grow in holiness. And so he seemed to say that the punishment language needs to be understood in terms of the sanctification model. And then by the time you get to Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical in the early 2000s, Spes Salvi on Christian Hope, he focuses exclusively on the sanctification model and the sanctification language and doesn't even mention temporal punishments. So it seems to me that how purgatory is understood has been in a kind of flux, with church authorities leaning more towards the sanctification model. And that would suggest, to get to your question, Ryan, that would suggest that we would tend to understand the treasury of merits in some more personalistic way rather than simply an accounting procedure. It would involve drawing upon the things that people have done and that have pleased God in a more existential, personal way that performs healing on individuals rather than just a penal or judicial or legislative shifting of numbers from one column to another.
Ryan, appreciate the call. I have to go to a break. I hope that that was helpful to you. Thank you so much for the call. Carlo's book, Purgatory is for Real, that examines quite a bit about purgatory, is about to be out. In South Africa, you could probably get the electronic copy. I don't know about how the printed copy will do getting to you, but I just wanted to suggest it to you. You might take a look over at the shop at shop.catholic.com and see about getting Carlo's book, Purgatory is for Real. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin Open Forum, Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Open Forum, and Jimmy Akin, our guest, both hours. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We don't usually get quite as many calls as we are getting today from our own home state of California. We go now to Menifee, California. We're an anonymous caller watching on YouTube. Anonymous, you there with us?
Hello?
Hi, I'm Anonymous. Go ahead with your question. Yeah.
Hi. Okay, so I was wondering, okay, so there's this show like Naruto. It's like a Japanese, or I don't know what Japanese, but it's anime. And they're like ninjas, right? And they have like chakras, mm-hmm. and they use like hand signs to do like, you know, activate their stuff, I guess, you know, or like, you know, focus a certain part of their body, whatever.
They also run in a funny way, like I'm given to understand.
It's cool. It's very funny. But some of these hand signs are like, or not some, I'm pretty sure they are like Chinese astrology hand signs or whatever. And some, like, it's taken from like Buddhism, Hinduism, like apparently, like, I don't know the validity of this claim, this exact one, but like they were like, the ninjas used to like do these like before they would do ninjutsu or whatever, whatever that is.
Anonymous, I'm going to help you out just a little bit to get to a question here. It seems like, so you're watching this Japanese anime show, they use these hand signs that have to do with astrology and possibly other religions. I'm guessing that you're wondering, is it okay to watch this show if you are a Catholic person? Am I in the ballpark, Anonymous?
Yeah.
Okay, Jimmy?
And go ahead. Like other shows like that, too.
Yeah, other shows of similar nature. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Yeah, so one of the things I would be careful about here is this claim even accurate, that these are some kind of astrological or religious hand signs? I am unaware of. Now, I'm not an expert in Japanese astronomy or astrology, but I'm not aware of it involving any hand signs. Typically, cross-culturally, this is not just in Japan, but cross-culturally, when astrologers do their work, it involves their hands only to the extent that they're making calculations on paper. And it doesn't involve special gestures or anything like that. So I would want to, if it were me and I was interested in this question, I would want to check it out and see, is this even true or is this just an internet rumor? But let's suppose that there is some kind of special astrological significance that some of these hand signs have. Well, if that's the case, it may or may not be playing a role in this show. I mean, there are only a certain number of gestures that humans can do with their hands. And so consequently, different cultures assign different meanings to these. And just because a hand sign means one thing to one group of people doesn't mean that it has that same meaning every time it gets used. It may mean something completely different to some other group. And so even if there is some group of astrologers somewhere that has a bunch of hand signs that mean something to them, that doesn't mean that that's what it means in the context of this show. Even if it is, though, let's grant that one too. Let's say they do have astrological or religious significance in this show. That doesn't mean they have it to me. You know, I'm not a believer in Japanese astrology. I'm not a believer in Shintoism. So even if these characters are doing something that has religious or astrological significance, you know, to the characters, well, I'm not one of those characters. I don't have to endorse what I see characters do in fiction. In fact, all fiction involves people doing things that they shouldn't, or it's boring, because there needs to be dramatic tension. You need heroes and villains, and the heroes don't have to be perfect, and the heroes don't have to, because they live in an imaginary world, they don't have to all follow the rules that apply in the real world. I can imagine, well, what if God made the world differently so that these people could do whatever amazing, you know, feats they are capable of, like running with their arms flailing behind their back so they can storm Area 51. You know, I don't have to accept fantasy and apply the rules of our reality to it. So as a result of all that, I would say that it's not in principle to watch it wrong, to watch such depictions, because you don't have to endorse everything they're doing and say, oh, yeah, we should do something like that in the real world. As long as you're capable of distinguishing fantasy from reality and saying, okay, that's not our world, we're not doing that, then it's not in principle wrong to watch this. Now, if it presents a temptation to you to want to do such things in the real world, you know, like get into, you know, other religions or get into weird occult practices or something, well, then you shouldn't watch it. But as long as you're secure in your faith and you're not being tempted to let fantasy spill over into your real life, then it's not in principle wrong. And that applies not just to this show, but other similar shows. If it creates a temptation for you, well, then avoid it. But if it doesn't, it's not wrong in principle.
Thanks, Anonymous. Appreciate the call. Appreciate it very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. The lines continue full, so we go now to Sandpoint, Idaho. Debbie, watching on YouTube in Sandpoint, Idaho. Your question, Debbie.
Yes, a gentleman named Ron White said back in the 1980s that he was directed by the Lord to a cave that he found the Ark of the Covenant in, along with other things like Goliath's sword and things of this nature.
Wow,
and
really?
If there's any fact in this. Yeah, I found it on YouTube, and it's a fantastic story, but I'm just, and he says that the Israel government has covered up some of his findings.
Well, they would.
Yeah, I think you're I'm just saying teasing. That tongue in cheek, Sai.
Yeah, I'm just teasing, because, all right, so if you, Ron White says he found the Ark of the Covenant and Goliath's sword.
Okay.
You heard anything about this?
Not this specifically. There have been a lot of people who have claimed to find the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, so this is another one to add to the list. It's also very unlikely that it would be found in proximity to a sword that was known to be Goliath's.
Yeah.
I mean, this is much more, and there's a lot of antiquities fraud as it is. But this is much more likely to be something that is not true than something that is actually true. And the fact that, oh, well, for those, you know, the Israeli government won't let me show you the evidence. Okay, then what we have here is a case of the missing evidence. And the burden of proof, as far as I'm concerned, is always on the person who is making an amazing assertion in the absence of evidence. If someone's making an amazing assertion like I found the Ark of the Covenant or I found Goliath's sword, much less finding both of them in one place, then okay, if you want me to believe that, the burden of proof is on you. And if you, for whatever reason, can't show me any evidence, then I'm going to be inclined to look at that skeptically and say, I think you're someone who's aware that the public has legs and is trying to pull one of them.
What do you think, Debbie?
I completely agree. I just wanted to get someone else to say it to me.
Yeah, I know that. I know exactly that feeling. Yeah, I need a reality check. That's what we call that, a reality check. All right, Debbie, thanks. Personally, I would hope they would find the hair of Goliath. Then you can make a wig out of it, and then you might
okay.
have... Well, wasn't it his hair that gave him superpowers?
Samson.
Samson. Oh, I don't know what I was thinking. Oh, man, that's embarrassing. Nick, why do you let me do it?
Actually,
you should hit the dump button when I'm going with the wrong guy.
David cut off Goliath's head.
I know, but it's a big
took
sword.
The hair with it.
I can't believe I confused Goliath with Samson. Well, it's a Thursday. When we come back to you, what's on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World this week? We got to take a quick break. If you're on the line, hang on the line. But now I'm going to find out what's on Mysterious World.
Okay. We're going to be talking about the Canadian priest, Father Michel Rodrigue, and doing an investigation of whether his dramatic revelations are actually true or not.
All right. You can trust Jimmy. He never would confuse Goliath and Samson. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum. Please, if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, you can go ahead and try 888-318-7884. Open Forum means open to anyone, any question at all. Right back with more of that right after this.